people should know when they're conquered.
This is History AF. I'm Sean, and we definitely didn't have to re-record this because I fucked up the audio the last time. Joining me for this endeavor, part two, is, of course, Leighton Jordan. Hey, buddy. Welcome back.
I fucking hate you right now. God.
Yeah, we have to go over...
We're going to go over this again.
At least it's not episode
the
one.
The first one.
Yeah.
Bro, just the abyss staring.
Yeah, it could be worse. It could just be us looking at the void of human consciousness as we try to figure out why sexual assault is used in a weaponry fashion. But no, this time it's just good old-fashioned regular war, which has a lot of sexual assault. But we don't need to talk about that because it's not during an actual full-on genocide. Just a couple of minor genocides going on. So to get started here... on June 28th, 1914, Archduke Franz Ferdinand was assassinated by Gavrilo Princip, a 19-year-old Bosnian who was part of the Serbian separatist group known as the Black Hand, a Marvel bad guy group if you've ever heard one.
Hold on. What if there was like a group of black people that were just like the Buttercream Gang, and then so racist, they're like, they're the Black Hands. Like, no, we just happen to have black hands. We aren't the Black Hands. Like,
also,
you know,
we're not in Bosnia.
Right.
This event would be the match thrown into the Wile E. Coyote amount of powder kegs and TNT that was Europe at the time. The Great War, as it had been dubbed at the time, took some 15 to 22 million lives, with another 22 million wounded. Roughly 2% of the world population died in the 4 years that it lasted. That's also not including those that died from the Spanish flu. So that's
because that was at the
same time. Which, by the way, and I don't know if I can really write much of an episode. I probably could based on yellow journalism.
You gonna make fun of the Asian, Sean? Jesus.
No.
Yeah. Oh.
No.
From deep.
Yellow journalism is not that. For anyone that doesn't know, yellow journalism is
that was so great.
Pretty much Fox
We're
News.
We're gonna get canceled.
Yeah, probably. No. But the Spanish flu, as it was dubbed, the only reason it was called that, because it was everywhere. The United States had people that were dying left and right. So did most of Europe, Africa, the Ottoman Empire. It was called the Spanish flu solely because Spain was one of the few countries that wasn't really involved in the war. And
they really missed out.
Well, and they had a more open press, so the press wasn't restricted to not talking about how everyone was dying from a giant flu epidemic, wherein, yes, the good old USA, England, France, Germany, everyone else was restricting their press from talking about this flu epidemic. But then once the Spanish were talking about it, that's when they were like, oh, it's the Spanish flu. It's those damn Spanish. No, it's killing plenty of people. You can find pictures if you Google it. Just Spanish flu masks, for example. People were tying cloth around their face and wearing masks. So anytime you see someone saying the mask wearing is stupid, tell them that their great-grandfather wore one so he wouldn't die in 1914.
Let's add in some context. Not too many people were brushing their teeth on a regular basis. So I think that was kind of just like, bro, wait, we can cover our mouths and people not think we're just making fun of their shitty-ass stank breath.
Well, this was before the Great Depression, literally right before the Great Depression. So I think people were at least kind of taking care of themselves a little bit.
One would hope.
Now, the reason I brought that up, yes, this is still the episode about Africa, sorry, but the reason I brought that up is because I want you to remember those numbers. That we had 15 to 22 million lives lost specifically from the war, and then another 22 million wounded. Rwanda and the assassination of President Habyarimana, much like Ferdinand and his assassination, were the match that set ablaze the continent of Africa in the 100 days of mass full-on genocide. After the RPF overthrew the Hutu-run government, it displaced the Hutus west into eastern Zaire, where some 1.5 million Hutus became refugees. These refugees included the former Hutu military and the Interahamwe, the Hutu civilian militia, and Théoneste Bagosora. The Hutus allied with the Mai Mai militia, which assisted in providing weapons and was mainly focused on protecting their own local territory. However, the Mai Mai and Hutus slowly went from defensive to offensive, striking out at the Banyamulenge and Banyarwanda, which are two other tribes local in the area. To step back for a moment again, let us revisit the stage for today, the Congo, or at the time, Zaire. And it was still ruled by Mobutu Sese Seko, who had ruled Zaire since 1965 after he led an American-backed coup in 1960, which ended with President Lumumba's execution by firing squad. He was subsequently buried, but later dug up and chopped up by hacksaws to be dissolved in acid to cover up the execution.
Hold on a second. If I'm going to die by firing squad, I'm taking off money. Like, you're going to have to earn these. Like, I'm not just letting you kill me. Fuck you. Like, no. Like, no. Nah, I'm running. Stand still. No, you're going to shoot me anyway. I'm going to turn into Barry Sanders on a great day. Fuck you.
I like that at some later point they were like, no, nah, this is too obvious. Bring him back up. Come on, we're throwing him in a vat of acid. Let's go.
Right.
What's it with dictators and vats of acid? It's annoying.
How do they just get that shit around?
Where like, do you Africa. Buy like, where a do you vat of
buy
acid?
Vat of acid? Where do you just buy acid and in a vat? Like, nah, like, I need about, you know, a couple more gallons. All right, weirdo.
Fine.
Like,
here's
oh, you're getting rid
barrels?
Of a dictator, aren't you?
Mobutu took over a country in strife that was a financial disaster. Zaire had few good roads for transportation. The constant fighting had displaced thousands. And in order to quell the eastern part of Zaire, the part with all the mining riches, Mobutu used foreign mercenaries. It took until 1967 for Zaire to stabilize as the horizon of the Vietnam War took hold, which led to a boom in the copper market, a market that Zaire had a big hand in. Mobutu was able to make large gains through the sale of copper, especially to the U.S. These gains increased after Mobutu nationalized the former Belgian copper company Union Minerai. But, like most authoritarians and economies, not a damn thing trickled down. The three most needy sectors, transportation, agriculture, and healthcare, received next to no financial assistance from this sudden boon of riches between 68 and 74. Mobutu did what any worthwhile kleptocrat does. He stole fucking everything.
He even took the Who hash. Or the Hutu hash.
The Who...
Bro, oh, I'm on fire.
He traded the Hutu hash for a shitload of Chinese guns, and I'm not making that up. So Mobutu
that was after Mao, so they might have been working.
Yeah,
pre-1949 China gun, better off just throwing the bullets.
Yeah, but post, they did actually have because the Chinese after World War II, after the 50s, really started getting a lot of armament from the Russians. And we're also building a lot based off of, I believe, Eastern European / Russian designs. So they were doing their own weapon manufacturing at the time as well.
Because when they tried to make steel, fuck that. It's horrible. No, just make it in your backyard. Steel? Yeah, use a pot. A clay pot? Mm-hmm. Bro, we're fucked. We are going to get so taken over by the Japanese again. Oh, man, our leader's a fucking idiot.
So Mobutu would sink money into extravagant and expensive endeavors that would never be finished. He funneled billions into personal accounts and to his most loyal supporters. In 73, he began nationalizing foreign-owned businesses, which he dubbed Zaireanization. This was done to cull foreign influence in Zaire, or at least that is what Mobutu would say publicly. In reality, he wanted to use these businesses, which were thriving, as more pawns to siphon funds from or to give as rewards. These businesses would go on to fail, forcing Mobutu to nationalize them further to keep them afloat. As Vietnam winded down, so did copper sales. Zaire was entering a dark period, and it was due to Mobutu treating the country like a personal checking account. He spent every cent he could find and invested next to nothing in infrastructure, well-being, healthcare, or even simple roads. As government income dropped, It began pulling what little it provided, leaving small localities to essentially their own devices. To make it worse, the Zaire military barely existed, and after facing an internal uprising aided by Angola, Zaire only survived by Western nations covertly winning the war on their behalf. Zaire was in literal shambles.
That just sounds like the heading of their entire decades. Zaire in literal shambles. Like, all right, yep.
Pretty much, from 64 on, which, I mean, is only 4 years after he usurped control. Basically, Zaire / Congo is an absolutely desolate, completely pointless place to stay. Because if you're not in the capital city of Kinshasa, then it's nothing. Just, it's free game. There's no rules. There's no anything.
Mad Max.
It's quite literally just Mad Max, but instead of desert, it's, you know, a very lush jungle, essentially.
That's just, like, there's so many times, like, way you could just cut that. Zaire, shit got worse. Like,
pretty much the recorded history, as far as we know, is essentially, pretty much Zaire, then the Congo, it just keeps getting worse. Because even to today, it just keeps getting worse.
Right.
By 77, the deficit was a third of the national debt and 60% inflation was standard. This dwindling income forced Mobutu to take out private loans from France, the IMF, and World Bank. The debt would reach $10 billion by 1990, as Mobutu enjoyed protection by his Western allies who deemed him important in staving off the feared communism and Russian influence in general. He didn't use this loan money to jumpstart Zaire, but instead spent lavishly on himself and his supporters.
Coke and whores.
Yep. Letting the infrastructure of the country continue to fall apart. This led to public servants not getting paychecks and produced an informal market. Unpaid police and soldiers would work as muscle or guns for hire. Merchants and laborers would trade and work outside of Zaire in other countries or for external companies. Smuggling became a normal job, as 50% of all coffee produced in Zaire was smuggled out, as was 70% of diamonds and 90% of ivory. The failure of Zaire was the boon of neighbors receiving these goods at bargain prices and left Zaire with no real income aside from aid provided by Western nations, aid which Mobutu would directly put into his pocket and give to his loyalists.
And the drug dealers and the whores.
Yes. I mean, literally the only people getting paid are those that are directly connected to him, or even the people that are supposed to be protecting him, his very small contingent of soldiers, even they get missed paychecks. This dude,
I was like, we gotta kill this motherfucker.
This is one of the greediest human beings to ever exist. I've written about a lot of really ultra just filthy rich bastards, and none of them can even touch Mobutu in the lack of fucks given about the people he's supposed to lead. There's
Xi Jinping.
No, because even he is focused on controlling the economy and making sure it doesn't fall apart. He's horrible, and he's literally doing a genocide, but he's not siphoning every single dollar given to China into his own physical pocket the way that Mobutu straight up is.
Hold on, sidebar. China is now allowing families to have a third child. You know what they could do? Stop murdering the Muslims that they have there.
Yeah, that would be really nice if they'd stop, like, killing literally people that are just Western Chinese. That'd be real nice.
Like, man, we need more people. Too many people are dying. Hey, kill those guys though. What the, like, I don't,
now you can have kids. Now you can have more kids. You're welcome.
Right.
As can be assumed, this contributed to mass death. With next to no healthcare, infrastructure, or anything, people died by the thousands to diseases that were preventable. By the turn of the 90s, the Cold War ended with the USSR dissolving, and thus the US propping up client states, which was running up spending by the billions, was no longer necessary. The final plug holding together Zaire was pulled when the Western nations, primarily the US, pulled its funding. With the USSR being ripped apart by oligarchs and the US with a surplus of military hardware, both groups now flooded the market with affordable equipment, which also tanked the already struggling copper prices globally. In 91, yeah, so their entire economy, which is what's going to happen to like Saudi Arabia and Venezuela, the one trick pony economies, once that resource is rendered just bargain priced, then you're screwed. There's not much more you have to offer.
Should have started selling coke, baby.
In 91, Mobutu had stripped Zaire so much that he could not afford to pay his military. The advice he gave, he told them to live off the land. He also apparently said to a soldier, "You have a gun. Why do you need pay? Take what you need."
Bro, the arrogance of, nigga, you know I'm gonna shoot you, right? Like,
yeah, wouldn't you really think like, that's a good point, and then just point the gun at him and be like, "Hey, where's your plane keys? You got keys for that plane?
Run them cheeks, boy." What? Yeah.
Here's a pickle.
You didn't see it. You didn't see this going this way, did you? Run them.
An event known as the pillages, sparked by Mobutu's comments and lack of being able to pay, began in the capital Kinshasa and quickly filtered throughout Zaire. This decimated 90% of Zaire's legitimate economy, but then turned on the black and gray markets as well. Mobutu and the ruling elites survived due in part to this rebellion having no clear motivation and no clear leadership. Inflation at this time, between 91 and 95, reached a peak of 9,769%, while the annual average prior was around 3,616%.
Bro, they're so broke, you can't afford to not be.
They're so broke that they literally just can't do anything. It's you're opening the pockets.
You're on a barter system.
Quite literally, now it's quite literally just a trading, you know, furs for food. I mean, it's literally a trading post in America in the 1700s.
Oh, imagine giving up your ass for some corn. That is going to be like, "Hey, sweetie, my cheeks are tired. We're family. Go ahead and make this happen. Richer for poor." That's a hard conversation. Like, I'm joking, but just like, bro, that's a hard conversation.
I mean, you're acting like sex wasn't traded. Sex wasn't a commodity that was absolutely traded. It absolutely was traded.
The desperation of it all.
Well, it's just like we can actually trace Lewis and Clark. We can trace their path, their journey that they took because of all of the mercury that they left. And why did they leave all that mercury? Because they couldn't stop fucking and they kept having syphilis. So they were taking mercury, which is what the medication was was the medication for syphilis. And we are able to trace it through their literally shitting out and pissing out mercury all the way there. That's quite literally how we can trace that.
You know, there's some things that I wish I didn't know that I'll now keep with me forever and ever that I'll never get to use in polite conversation.
There's no using that outside of a podcast.
At all.
You can't be hitting on someone in a bar and be like, "Hey, by the way, did you know how we were able to track Lewis and Clark on their expedition?"
What did they use before mercury? Did they liquefy it? Were they just holding on? Were they stuffing the pellets into their pee hole? Were they eating it and taking it like a pill?
They were taking it like a pill. It was like mercury. I think it was liquid form, I believe, and they would just kind of like shoot it.
Bro, did they live?
They didn't know.
You die from mercury poisoning pretty fast.
You're talking about a time when doctors didn't think it mattered to wash your hands between shoving your hands in patients.
Bro, what other, like, did they go with like Romulum or like Bromium? Like, did they try iron? Like, the fuck, man?
I have no
idea. Dirty bat. Bro, I now have so less respect for Sacagawea. Like, you set your people up. But then again, they weren't her tribe. She's like, "I don't give a fuck about these Montana motherfuckers. I'll never see them." And how young was this girl?
I think Sacagawea was like 15 or 16, if I remember correctly.
Hopefully she didn't. I mean, I'm pretty sure at that time she looked like a 15, 16-year-old, which is probably like a 12, 13-year-old at that time.
It doesn't matter because a 15 or 16-year-old was marriage. Like, that was her. Yeah. She at that point in that time period, if you were 16, you were probably married with a kid.
Let's get back to this atrocity.
Yep, it gets worse for everyone. To resolve this, Mobutu began issuing $5 billion notes he called Zaire's.
Okay, Dr. Evil.
Just imagine, like, it's the thing that I liken it to, and I might actually put it in here, and I'll just repeat it, I don't care. It's basically the Bison Bucks from Street Fighter, the movie.
Yeah.
He quite literally, and of course, you know, this motherfucker put his face on it. So
with this stupid fucking hat,
with the damn leopard skin hat, a $5 billion banknote. That's what we're talking about. So if you look at a $10 or a $20 or even get you a Franklin to look at, imagine that was a $5 billion with a B dollar note. It's it's so funny. Merchants refused to accept it, and it was used to pay soldiers who mutinied, which led to their looting of Kinshasa in 93. Unrest grew all over Zaire, which had a location problem. All the major cities were far apart. Kinshasa on the far west, Lubumbashi was in the far southeast, and Kisangani in the far north. This created border issues, made it easy to smuggle in and out, and made it nearly impossible to centralize control over a spread-out population. By the time of the Rwandan genocide, Zaire was a failed state. It had no money, no active military, no centralized government, and no foreign aid to fall back on. It was what is deemed a, quote, warlord state, and Mobutu was the one sitting in a palace with no country to call his. Zaire was now basically an extinct nation. The former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State to Africa, Herman J. Cohen, said of it, quote, "There is no real government authority outside the capital city." Because no one truly pressed Mobutu's power, he merely sat there and waited for the inevitable. As covered in the previous episode, the Rwandan genocide was a horrible event that claimed 800,000 or more lives in 100 days, on top of the countless murders after that time frame. Both the Rwandan Hutu government and the RPF utilized child soldiers to carry out murders and rapes, and after it all, a large number of Hutus fled to Zaire fearing retribution after the RPF took control of Rwanda. After the RPF, composed primarily of Tutsis, took control of Rwanda, it set about restructuring the government. It maintained some Hutus in visible governmental positions, but most vital positions were reserved for Tutsi Rwandans. They received $68.5 million in June of 1995, a first installment of a $600 million aid package given to the RPF. Step one for the RPF was to enact punitive measures against those who were deemed to have been part of the genocide. Because nearly all judges and lawyers had been murdered, only 36 judges and 14 prosecuting lawyers were left in the entire country.
They didn't just bounce?
They didn't have time.
Don't you work for Jenkins, Smith, and Jones? Nope, quit yesterday. I'm a bus driver now. Fuck that.
This led to jail overcrowding and eventually to the RPF instituting their own form of judgment and execution. RPF
goes to that.
Yeah, pretty much. Well, in this instance, not defending it, but what the hell are you supposed to do? You literally don't have any judges and you don't have any lawyers because they all just got murdered. So
there's no law.
They're going the military tribunal route, essentially, which...
Doesn't that technically make them judges?
Yes, this is basically Judge Dredd in Central Africa.
Bro.
That's basically what you're getting. The RPF police were tasked with arrests, sentencing, and extrajudicial verdicts. This became an issue as the RPF needed to convince the Hutus that had fled to return. This bore its own problems, though, as the Interahamwe were still at large. Geographically, if you look at the Rwandan and Congolese borders, there was a large body of water between them. This is Lake Kivu. The Interahamwe had formed into a pair of divisions, one south of Kivu and one north of Kivu in Mobutu, Zaire. The refugee camps of the fleeing Hutus had these genocidal militias and their officers, including the deposed Hutu government, primarily in the eastern part of the Congo. Mobutu was sympathetic to the Hutus, because of course he was, allowing them to retain their military might while in the Congo, as if he could do anything about it anyway.
Right.
This led to the military and former government establishing control over the camps, food supply, and travel. As soon as dominance was established, the Interahamwe began running sorties against the Rwandan border. On October 31st of 94, one such attack led to the murder of 36 in the city of Gisenyi, which is right next to the Congo border city Goma. This and many other small attacks pricked away at the thought of stability, as the RPF could not ignore what the Interahamwe were preparing to do, reinvade Rwanda.
Oh, God.
Yep.
Well, much.
Yeah. They can't just stop. That's what kind of annoys
me. I mean, they could.
They could, but they won't.
They're just like, let's keep this momentum going. You could stop this bad decision making, but you're not, because what else are you going to fucking do? Like, they didn't have much guidance to begin with. It's not like the schools are perfect. It's just like you have a whole bunch of people doing a bunch of fuck shit, and there's no real way to stop it because there's no one really to police it all. Like,
well, and the people up top are pushing for this. They want to do this. There's really no resistance to it. Their leadership group is dead set on literally genocide. I mean, that's it.
It's got to be very tiring to just all day wake up. Like, it just has to...
To just wake up and be racist all day?
Yeah. The PTSD of seeing your people die also mixed in with the PTSD of you just doing mad killings indiscriminately. That has to eat at some semblance of a fucking soul.
It has to be exhausting.
Like, no one can just be a part of that.
It has to be exhausting.
Do every day? Like, do you even eat your favorite food?
It's got to be tiring to just constantly just... Every day, you're focused
on... Murder, snack, murder. Again, sleep.
Now, when the Hutu government and Interahamwe fled, they took with them the available treasury, which amounted to tens of millions. So with a
like
healthy...
Millions or like Mbutu bucks?
No. No. Actual...
A bunch of Chuck E. Cheese coupons.
No, they had better than tokens for Dave and Buster's. They didn't have they didn't have the DMB credit card.
Had one for fucking Discovery Zone, because at least Dave and Buster's is still up and running.
True. No, they had legitimately tens of millions that they stole. And with that healthy amount of funding and a former Eastern Bloc country being widely available... for selling a bunch of arms, they were looking to buy, and these Eastern Bloc countries are looking to sell because they need the money after the USSR fell apart. It allowed the Interahamwe to purchase as many weapons and as much ammo as they wanted. To make matters worse, to make matters worse, Mobutu had no problem allowing the Interahamwe use of the Eastern Congo to set up their invasion. He even helped them secure an arms deal with Chinese dealers. Mobutu's actions made it impossible for the RPF government in Rwanda to discern and reintegrate Hutus that had fled to camps. There were 2 million Rwandan Hutus in refugee camps and 5 million Rwandans of varying tribes in Rwanda itself. The world poured some $2 billion worth of aid into the camps between 94 and 96, but only about 900...
Oh, they had aid.
Yeah, they had
lots
money.
Of aid.
Yeah, they had money.
So much aid.
But only about 900 million was provided to the RPF, the government of Rwanda now. This was on top of next to no policing of these camps by the UN while an awkward situation was bred. The United States had backed the RPF entirely, while the French preferred the controlled previous regime, pitting the powers against each other in a weird way. The RPF wanted two major things: to get rid of these refugee camps, thus bringing the population back into the country, and to find and destroy the Interahamwe. Doing this would be impossible without first removing Mobutu and his protections. Let us turn now to Angola. While Rwanda while Rwanda is just slightly bigger than New Jersey, Angola is close to twice the area of Texas. Angola had been embroiled in a civil war since the mid to late 70s, and come the mid 90s, the opposition group Unão Nacional para a Independência Total de Angola, or as I'm going to from here on out say UNITA, became the primary antagonist to the ruling party. Movimento Popular de Libertação, I'm not saying that right, de Angola, or MPLA. Jonas Savimbi had founded UNITA, and despite ethnic tensions also existing in the country, MPLA was controlled by the coastal elite, and thus UNITA became the party of the everyman by default for the lower class, which was...
Hold on a second. What the fuck you mean by elite? They're in Africa in a war to, like... Wait, like, they have $5 more than other motherfuckers they're fighting?
Well,
like,
these are all the people that control the economy, and they're all their own little fiefdom Mobutu thing. Well, these are the... Like, Angola's primary thing was oil, and oil
thinking,
was one
I'm
of their...
Zaire, my bad.
No, yeah. No, this is Angola, not Zaire. No, in Angola, it's the ruling elite is... It's essentially a bunch of... you know, fiefdom robber barons, and they're paying the military and everyone else's SOL.
Like,
it's quite literally
for having the one fucking ice cream machine works, you son of a bitch.
Angola is another one of those countries that, you know, they're very much an economy that's very heavy on oil. And because whenever oil crashes, which may be in our lifetime, probably will be, there's about five or six countries right off the bat that are just going to fall apart. And they,
like paper mache in the water.
Quite literally. And they're going to probably get swallowed up by whatever the closest hegemony is. I mean, Venezuela is going to get controlled by the U.S. most likely.
I think Colombia is going to have something to say about that. It'll get absorbed into Ecuador.
I've got a strong militaristic advantage going between the U.S. and literally any country in South America. There's just
get them all hooked on coke.
While
You've
oil
seen it done before.
While oil will tank eventually and it'll ruin these countries' economies, oil will still have a purpose. It will still exist as a good. It just will not be what everyone is using for their vehicles and such.
Gotcha.
Now, Angola was rich with diamonds and oil, but per usual, the oligarch wealthy class hoarded as much as they could. The financial tensions were strong, and this high poverty rate that was created by the upper crust had contributed to the lengthy civil war. While the MPLA relied almost entirely on oil exports, UNITA utilized gold and specifically diamonds for income. UNITA had a working relationship with close Mobutu allies in the Congo, whom they bought weapons from using diamonds. This caused the MPLA to try to find a solution working with Mobutu to remove UNITA's not-so-secret 15,000-man army that was in the Congo along with various military assets and bases. But, because Mobutu basically had no control outside of the capital of Kinshasa, and because his military basically didn't exist on top of his waning influence, the MPLA realized he could not keep his word even if he meant it. The Banyamulenge Rebellion in October of 96 brought an alliance of the Banyamulenge, Rwandan Tutsi, and a militia that had been run by Laurent Désiré Kabila, called the Alliance of Democratic Forces for the Liberation of Congo, or the, I'm not saying that, we're just going to call it the AFDL.
Okay.
I can't say that in French. I don't think I can, at least. The AFDL creation was assisted heavily by Paul Kagame, as it included Rwandan-trained soldiers, as well as regulars of the recently established Rwandan Defense Force, or RPA. Laurent Désiré Kabila had been around since the 60s. He established his own group called the Parti de la Révolution Populaire, or PRP. In 1975, Kabila and the PRP abducted four zoologists from Tanzania that worked with Jane Goodall and successfully ransomed $500,000 for their release. You know who Jane Goodall is. She's the woman
the monkey lady.
That worked with like gorillas and there's a dozen documentaries about her and her work.
She did something with gorillas. There's no way gorillas was just like, who the fuck is this super pale standing up lady?
I've got it. Like, that's one of the weird things to me is watching that. There's a lot of because a gorilla can kill you without a second thought. It just
on its way to get some cheeks.
It could just getting up to look at you, it could tear your face off in a moment's notice. I'm good.
Oh,
that's
God.
A little too much for me to even think about. Kabila had worked out an agreement with the military under Mobutu in the late 70s and early 80s, where he would trade gold and ivory with them, and the military would protect his business by simply claiming the area was controlled by the rebellious PRP. It worked out nicely until the PRP attacked the Zairean forces in the mid-80s and were forced to retreat to Tanzania. Kabila is a unique individual. In the mid-60s, he worked with Che Guevara, aiming to bring a Cuban-esque revolution to the Congo. Che failed due in part to Kabila. As Che put it, Kabila was late delivering supplies, sometimes by days. He did not back up Che's men when requested. He did not take orders well. And Che remarked that he did not seem revolutionarily serious and was uncommitted.
This dude is a fuck.
He's not good at this. He did state that Kabila did have the qualities of a mass leader, however, but what can be seen as we continue on is that Kabila was someone who only did things his way, much like the man he aimed to dethrone, Mobutu Sese Seko. Rwanda and Uganda were at the forefront of planning the invasion of the east of the Congo. Kabila was selected partly because he had no direct ties to either country, so no favoritism was to be worried about, and because it was determined by the Tanzanian higher-ups that he was harmless and easy to manipulate. These two pieces of information made Rwanda and Uganda happy to make Kabila their future puppet dictator.
That's always good.
When you start talking about, oh, he's so easy to manipulate, I guarantee you that is going to mean that he's not, and shit's going to blow up in your face almost every time.
Yeah, because if you're like, oh, yeah, like, we got this stupid bastard, like, bro, he's going to do something that's going to be fucking, what's the word? Going to be emotionally driven.
Yeah, every decision they're going to make, and they're going to have that pressure. You don't think they're going to hear from people around them saying, "Hey, they're saying that you're a puppet for the Rwandans. You're a puppet for so and so." Of course, that's going to get back to him. Of course, it is.
Yeah,
What's the old saying? Don't assume because you make an ass out of you and me. It just all these assumptions that everyone, right. This whole story is everyone making fucking assumptions. That's what it is.
It is. And it's just a whole slew of people not realizing how fucked they're going to be when their prize pony ends up being a dumbass.
Not just is he just dumb with decision making. He's really bad at leading. He's really, yeah. really bad at it, as we'll get to. The Congo takes up half of the middle of Africa. To its south on the west end is Angola. To the east is Rwanda and Burundi, which are both small. East further is Tanzania, and north of Rwanda is Uganda. Rwanda and Angola had their own reasons for entering this conflict, but their reasons were almost identical. Angola worried about UNITA and Rwanda about the Interahamwe. Mobutu had helped both by allowing them to stay within his borders and, in some cases, assisting with arms deals or providing supplies outright. Neither country could trust its border as long as Mobutu stayed in control, however little control it may be. The AFDL made initial gains of around 500 miles long and 57 miles inland in the Kivu area along the Congolese borders with Burundi and Rwanda in 96. This fast push gave a healthy border for the AFDL's United Group, which began moving westward in December of 96. The AFDL focused on taking towns and mines to shore up control and income. At the end of March in 97, the AFDL took the town of Kasingi, which was 137 miles north of Lubumbashi in southern Congo. So they're facing no opposition.
Right, just riding right on in.
Yeah. After taking Kasinga, the AFDL and Kabila demanded that the Mobutu government surrender. This, of course, was dismissed as propaganda, and that they, the Mobutu forces, were defeating the AFDL. In reality, the AFDL faced basically no opposition. Kabila had been following the Congo River southward while a large detachment of the AFDL had gone north along the Congo River. winding through each town on their way to Kinshasa. Basically, everyone joined in on the AFDL party, as literally no one trusted nor allied with Mobutu. He was weak, had no control, and no army.
That seems about right.
Yep.
Yeah, like that seems a bit on brand. Like, you are a fucking loser, and we're just going to take your shit.
All of it. Literally, just no one's on board with you. Everyone's jumping over to our end, and best of luck, buddy.
Right.
The Zairean army had no pay or received pay equal to Bison Bucks and Street Fighter, and most deserted after looting the absolute shit out of where they were stationed. In March of 97, peace talks were proposed, but by this point, Kabila controlled 25% of the Congo and dismissed the idea of talks, stating that the current regime was irrelevant. By May, the AFDL was damn near at the door of Kinshasa, and on May 16th, Kabila took the airport of Lubumbashi. The AFDL now had air support and was able to travel to Kinshasa quickly. Mobutu, being the despot ruler who invested nothing into his country at all, had no air support, no army, no air defenses, and a united front against him.
Do you think at some point he's like, yo, I really suck at this?
I think he quite literally just kind of thought maybe they'll fight them back, or maybe they'll give up because there's literally no roads and they're having to walk through literal jungle. It was quite literally, he was just sitting there waiting for them to knock on the door so that he could just kind of up and dip.
Right. Like, bro, like, you've done some pretty bad things. People want to kill you.
You've done bad things and some people want to kill you, but then there's also the people that just, you didn't do anything for. So why would they, why would they have any allegiance to you? If you're living in some small town in, you know, the forest, essentially, why do you give a damn about Mobutu? Do you even know who he is? Like, that's also a question to ask.
Yeah, like, have internet.
This is also the mid-90s in fucking Congo. They do not have internet. It's all travel is word of mouth. That's quite literally what it is for a lot of these communities. They don't have a newspaper. They don't generally have a bunch of television. There's only three major cities that are cities in this country. Maybe four, if you include Kasingi. But there's only a small handful of communities that actually have what you would consider kind of like required first world living. A lot of the other ones are just farming communities, trade communities, very small, close-knit towns. There was no stopping any invasion force that had you could have taken the entire country with about 5,000 men. I'm not even joking.
Or 13 really nice tanks.
13 really nice tanks and a small
and like
contingent.
A couple jets.
And like 50 infantry. Like, just that's it.
Like the Michigan militia. Like, hey, boys, you guys are swinging for the fences. Why don't you try to take over the Congo? And then, you know, if they don't fucking kill you, but don't try to take over the United States. There's 13 of you.
So not only did the AFDL invade, but the Angolans had invaded from the south against their UNITA enemies as well. And Mobutu had no choice but to flee. Once the peace talks that took place on a South African vessel had failed between Kabila and Mobutu, which was helmed by Nelson Mandela, Mobutu fled. The only reason it took so long for the AFDL to advance was because Mobutu did not invest seemingly a single dollar into roadways or any sort of infrastructure. Mobutu stole everything, paid off his loyalists, and let his country rot. Eventually, Mobutu was forced to go to Morocco, where he would die on September 7th, 1997, due to prostate cancer. He was 66.
Yeah, he earned that one.
He did. While that is where Mobutu's sad and brutally greedy life ends, it is not where it ends for Kabila, the AFDL, the Congo, and basically all of Africa.
Right.
The same day that Mobutu fled, Kabila proclaimed victory and himself president all in one fell swoop. Damn near immediately, Kabila showed how inept he was and how much like his defunct predecessor he was. Kabila, like most warlord-style rulers, focused only on maintaining his own power. He initially set out a brutal crackdown to suppress any thoughts of overthrowing him, despite the population not showing any sort of desire to do so. Kabila began showing the typical weak narcissist signs as he purposefully would turn his subordinates against one another to force them to duke it out to curry favor with him.
It's always the dumb motherfuckers that think they're Machiavellian. Like, dude, they all really just creating a cabal of motherfuckers who are going to be out for themselves.
Yeah, well, it's in, you know, I try not to bring up a whole lot of current political anything very much in these because this is learning about shit that you didn't know. But Kabila, if you'll notice his style of pitting one against the other, it's very Trump-like in the whole you protect yourself by pitting everyone against each other to be able to have the favor of the king, so to speak. It's very much in that same regard. Kabila did that. The only difference is Kabila didn't actually have much of that aura, where Trump has that like aura because he's, you know, a perceived rich businessman. He at least has that to where he's viewed in a certain way. Kabila only did it to his subordinates because he was terrified. Trump does it because that's how he's run a business. So badly. I can at least give a mild amount of credit to Trump and moving from he did it here and it worked, so it should work over here too, even though it totally doesn't, nor would it ever. Kabila just
a logical looking ass daughter. She looks like a bird, bro. Bro, Ivanka Trump looks like a fucking bird.
I don't even remember which wife it was that birthed her. Was it
Ivana.
That's right.
Bro, and that was a model? Like, bro, Trump, you are. I mean, Jesus. Marla Maples was dope, but Jesus Christ.
I do want to say that one of the funniest tweets I've ever read is Trump exclusively slept with models, yet somehow his two sons literally look like Beavis and Butthead. And I had
no chin having ass bitches.
I had to laugh heartily at that one.
If I ever saw Donald Trump Jr., I would just laugh in his face. And even Eric, like, what are you going to do? Go get your bird sister. Squaw! That's all I would do. It's just all types of bird sound. I can't. Oh, my God. I hope they come to Ohio because I'm just bringing a megaphone. Or Portland. No, they're not going anywhere near Oregon. Fuck that. And it's going, squaw! Like, who keeps making that bird sound? And see if she responds.
They're not going to have any idea what you're doing. And I think that's why you'll get away with it.
That's right.
So he did keep those he distrusted in the dark on important matters, even if they were, you know, even if that was part of their job. He banned any and all political activities and was more interested in the flow of information than in actual governing. Because Kabila lacked overall support, he would do just things.
That's like saying I got 99 problems but a bitch ain't one. Like, bro, that's a lot of open-ended air right there. Like, a bitch isn't one of them. If I have 99 problems, I want bitches to be at least 83.
I have 99 problems and you would not believe what a majority of them are.
Oh my God.
So he would utilize unpredictability as a weapon. The reason I use Kabila and Trump very one-to-one is because they both... Kabila literally does the same shit that Trump did for the last 4.5 years. And it was weird reading more and more about him.
Nothing.
Well, it's weird reading more and more about how Kabila ran things, how he acted, how his personality was. We get more into it in the next episode too.
A lot of hyperbole.
There's so many one-to-one comparisons that are accurate. There's a couple things that they differentiated on, but there's so much one-to-one in how they liked doing things. It's just really weird. It's also funny to see how that style works in a third world versus a first world situation where there's checks and balances. Because as you'll see, the Kabila Trumpian style will not work.
No.
Spoiler. So as I said, he would just kind of do things. He would utilize unpredictability as his weapon. Sometimes he would jail certain former Mobutu officials. Sometimes he would jail his own officials. He never seemed to make moves with a reason. He had re-education camps set up for former Mobutu-era military, which primarily were there to embarrass, and even attempted to force the population into this as well. But it quickly faded away as the people despised it and it began causing problems. His decision-making was erratic, uncoordinated, and fearful.
Oh, he's like every bad leader ever.
He's quite like, literally...
Way to go, Nero, Caligula.
But even, like, even Nero invested in infrastructure. And yeah, I mean, at least...
watch it burn and play the fiddle.
And at least Caligula held mass executions. I don't know. Caligula was...
Yeah, I was like, I'm waiting for this one.
At least he fucking did something.
I
mean, Nero, there's actually some redeeming things that he did do. He got a lot of bad rap because of the writers. Anytime you're talking about ancient history, which I have a lot of episodes on that I need to do later, and a lot that I've written, Nero is not nearly as horrifyingly awful as everyone says he was, but he also still wasn't great. Caligula was fucking terrible.
Nero's like, hey, I pulled out when I banged my sister, so I'm not this weirdo Caligula.
Well, Caligula... That was the incest was the least weird thing, especially because incest was and is still relatively normal when you're talking about royalty. Royalty in general. But it's a very recent phenomenon that they don't fuck their siblings.
Knowingly.
Knowingly or openly.
Right.
But the Caligula would perform vivisection on people in front of their families. So he's his own level.
I don't know that word, and I don't want to know it yet. So just go ahead. Let's keep talking about this asshole in Africa.
Vivisection's where you remove the skin but leave everything on. Okay, so.
Come on. He flayed him?
Yeah, well, it's where you remove the skin, but you don't take off like the muscle and tissue. They're also not dead yet, so they're alive while you're taking off their skin.
He's a Baratheon, not a Baratheon, not sir. What the fuck was his name? Game of Thrones guy.
Yeah, the Roose Bolton.
Roose Bolton, that's it.
Ramses Bolton. Roose is his father. Kabila was also a failure in the Department of Diplomacy. The international community did not comprehend that Kabila, a former follower of the assassinated Prime Minister Patrice Lumumba, did not view them with any kind of respect. Kabila was fully aware of how the U.S. and Western Europe assisted and basically okayed the overthrow through Mobutu. Even after overthrowing Mobutu himself, Kabila made no attempts to solidify his power internationally. He would flat out not attend meetings that were set up. He would come late to meetings, and he did attend, and leave early before discussions had concluded. Kabila was emotional and lacked any sort of pragmatism that a head of state needs.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yep, he let his previous personal issues dictate how he handled things from a new leadership position, which is a big old no-no when you're talking about international state-to-state relations.
Right.
You can be pissed that they assassinated the guy that you were a follower of. However, holding that 30-year-old grudge is not going to solve anything for you.
Right.
To make things worse, Kabila refused the United Nations attempts to investigate accusations of genocide against Rwandan Hutus in 97. The AFDL and their Rwandan allies had blown through Congo at a fast pace considering the lack of roads and encountered villages, towns, and cities where, it can be assumed, some resistance was found, but a lot of vulnerable and innocent populations were as well.
Right.
Because of the refusal to allow investigation, Kabila irked many countries looking for a stable and notably better government in the Congo. Reports of continued slaughter, even after the fall of Kinshasa, and the fleeing of Mobutu trickled out of the Congo. But Kabila paid it no mind, and continued his strong-armed and hapless diplomatic approach.
He was just like, hold on, I wrote something down, I have something to say. What? Suck my dick. Wait, no, that came out wrong. Suck my dick. No, wrong word too. Suck my dick. Yeah, that feels better. Sorry, I'm leaving. I got chicken coming.
I got to get that emphasis right. Thank you for giving me that minute, though. I needed it. Good thing it was only three words.
Yeah. Like, don't you all feel better? I don't, because you haven't started sucking my dick yet. But, you know. Bro, this guy's just a piece of shit in the worst way.
He's an idiot. Like, the biggest thing is that he's this idiot that expects these countries to come groveling to him for some reason. Because he's... Like, dude, I don't want to be a dick, but who gave a fuck about the Congo? Like, no one cared about the Congo. They only cared in the international, oh, we want to stop the evil genocide. They only cared for political points / economic benefit. But even then, if they stabilized your government to then buy goods from you, it may be more expensive than what they were buying from smugglers as it was anyway.
Right. We can just take your shit. Like, you do realize that. Like, we can just show up and take everything. Like,
that is the weirdest thing. That is the weirdest fact, that you could literally just steal everything you wanted to from the Congo. And there's no lie there. There is no lie. You just send in a random group of people to mine, and you can.
They could just build the roads. Like, which I think is what China's doing now. Like, yo, we can just take this shit.
Yeah, we'll just make an offer that you can't refuse, and then once you take it and you screw it up, we'll take all your shit.
Even if you don't screw it up, we're going to take your shit.
Pretty much, we're going to keep giving you loans until you're in such debt that then we get what we actually wanted. The diplomatic issues are part of what Kabila's bigger problem was. The newly named Democratic Republic of the Congo was coming up on $14 billion in debt. Not only
Jesus
this,
Christ.
It's a shitload of money.
Hey, we ain't got it.
It's a shitload of money. Like, when you talk about national debts, it almost never matters. Like, whenever you hear it in the United States, the national debt's so fucking irrelevant, it doesn't matter. The U.S. has so many assets. And also, by the way, no, China doesn't own the U.S. Actually, the number one owner of U.S. debt is the U.S.
Yeah.
Is number one. Number two is actually Canada. Number three, I think, is Mexico, if I remember correctly. And I think
we owe money to Mexico.
Well, but we don't. Like, the whole thing is it's literally just based upon trade. So when you have NAFTA, when you have the free trade agreement was it NAFTA 2.0, whatever the hell Trump called it after he redid it, it's still free trade. So when we buy a bunch of stuff from Mexico, which we do buy a bunch of stuff from Mexico, that's
mostly
technically, technically a negative. When you go to McDonald's and get a number one with cheese, you look at your bank account, it says minus $8.99, right? That's technically an L. But you got to eat, so you're getting something for what you're spending. There's no national debt. It doesn't exist for the United States. It's a bullshit talking point that Republicans use every time a Democrat's in office, because, oh, now we have to rein back spending. No, you never do, because everything you're spending, you're purchasing goods that are being used in your economy. We have such a massive economy in the U.S., it doesn't matter. But for the Congo, there's no fucking economy. And everything is literally loan money that you now owe. So $14 billion in debt in the Congo fucking matters. $14 billion in debt, which I think ours is in the trillions, actually. But $14 billion in debt in the U.S. is irrelevant, because you have the assets to be able to offset that. We have this debt because we're purchasing goods from another country. The Congo has this debt because Mobutu is an asshole and wanted like a ninth boat.
Right. Then he died of colon cancer.
Yeah, and then all of his money, by the way, all of his money just kind of existed. That's one of my favorite parts, is the money didn't even go back. He stole all the money and took it to France. He took it to France and to Morocco, and that's where it was stashed.
What a fucking idiot.
What an asshole. That's why I say Mobutu, there's a lot of assholes in history. Mobutu's one of the biggest assholes in human history. Just the pure amount of greed, historically speaking. It's not like he actually manufactured anything. Like, he was a shitty businessman, you know? Like Henry Ford is your typical shitty businessman who is also a Nazi sympathizer. But he's a shitty businessman who actually produced something, and that's how he made all that money. This is a guy that's quite literally getting free money from a country and then taking all of it and putting it directly into his pocket.
But on brand for this type of asshole.
Yeah. So $14 billion in debt. Not only this, but the state income didn't exist. Kevin Dunn, in his book, A Survival Guide to Kinshasa, wrote, quote, Zairians had suffered for over three decades while Mobutu, supported by various international actors, such as the United States, France, and Belgium, had bled the country dry. It has been estimated that Mobutu and his close friends pillaged between 4 billion and 10 billion of the country's wealth, siphoning off up to 20% of the government's operating budget, 30% of its mineral export revenues, and 50% of its capital budget. Zaire's formal economy had shrunk by more than 40% between 1988 and 1995. Its foreign debt in 1997 was around $14 billion. At $117, its 1993 per capita gross domestic product was 65% lower than its 1958 pre-independence level. So I put, for comparison's sake, the U.S. per capita GDP in 1993 was $23,387.
Jesus Christ, this dude.
Kabila needed to rebuild the economy of the Congo, but his personal lust for power, coupled with his near-immediate distrust of the Rwandan and Ugandan advisors, who had helped usher him into a position once secured, sent him into a dismal path. Kabila, in his defense, was in a position that was entirely uncomfortable. He had been brought to power by Tutsis, and a lot of his military might was due to Rwanda and Uganda, which made him nervous as well as bitter, since it was perceived that he was a puppet of both countries. He did not have a good infrastructure foundation to rebuild Kinshasa on, let alone all of the Congo. The East was not secure and still had roving bands of RPA Rwandans, Maya Mayas, and Hutu Interahamwe. Because of the horrid situation the Congo was in, no international bank wanted to loan any money, since it was a sunk cost with low probability of success. Kabila was in an unfortunate and desperate situation. The six-month and 22-day-long war had 500,000 and 800,000 dead, some quarter million outright missing, and tens to hundreds of thousands displaced. We're talking about millions of people impacted by a six-month long affair, this whole situation.
That seems like it, that was going to happen.
Unfortunately, yeah. And there's nothing I can really do to shed light on any of that happening because we don't really have any documentation. I mean, it's a lot of kind of the he said, she said. You're getting it from a third party.
Who would want to know this shit? Like, how would you keep this information safe?
I searched a lot.
Fucking jungle, like, of the Congo. And they're like, oh, wait, the papers. Where's page 834?
Well, just no one. There was no scribe that was brought with this group with Kabila. There was no AFDL taking down the battle, so to speak.
They were probably murdered.
Well, the thing that we can for sure say is a lot of people died in this 6 months as they went from, you know, town to town, city to city, pillaging. Because the thing about armies is even if you have a very easy, you're facing no opposition, armies get bored. And when those soldiers, those hyped up, masculine, uber on adrenaline soldiers desperately want to do some manly shit, so to speak. They want to kill something. They want to fuck something. They want to eat something. They want to steal something.
Hopefully in different orders.
Hopefully not at all would be the nice thing.
True, that too. Like, I mean, kill, hunt something. There's a lot of wild boar out there or something. Do something constructive.
Well, it's why it's why all of these commanders that there's something I wrote about and it was really depressing, but there's a reason that all these commanders always just let their soldiers just rape. It's because if they don't, they know that they're going to get overthrown. They're going to have someone replace them. And they're terrified of mutiny because, I mean, you know, what are you going to do? Protect some girl that you don't even know and let yourself get killed? Or are you just going to just let your soldiers do whatever they want? Unfortunately, they always pick the latter.
That happens.
It is. It's a reality.
Cannibalism.
It's a reality, and we have to face the horrors that humans do. We are a horrible, horrible group, and we are super warlike, and we love war, and we love all of the things that come with it when you're on the aggressor end. When you're on the defensive end, not so much.
Bro, we're like essentially like we are animals. Like we're, in our most primitive things, we love eating. We love kill. We not love like we love eating and fucking. If we have to kill to do one of the two, that's what's gonna happen.
Yeah, it's that, absolutely
that's just facts.
It unfortunately we're animals that just so happen to have thumbs.
Yeah,
pretty much.
Oh my gosh. Let's continue. This is
well, we're just about at the end, so don't worry.
Yeah.
Kabila decided to make his power move. The Mai Mai had risen up in the east and were attacking areas randomly. The Interahamwe were making moves into Rwanda and attacking RPA and civilians alike. The RPA was attacking Hutu settlements in the eastern Congo, and the Burundians were joining in with the sparse skirmishes in the African version of the Wild West. On July 27th of 98, Kabila ordered all Rwandan troops out of the Congo and dismissed his Ugandan and Rwandan advisors. 5 days later, the coalition of Rwanda, Uganda, and Burundi assisted with two defecting brigades, the 10th and the 12th, from the forces Armées Congolaises invaded eastern Congo, kicking off the Second Congo War, also known as Africa's World War. And that is where we leave off.
Oh, it wasn't as depressing.
Not nearly as bad. This is much more war based, and it's. I mean, look, there's definitely a lot of rape, a lot of AIDS issues continuing on with a lot from the Rwandan genocide into this that continues. The difference being is we don't have nearly as much documentation. The Congo is gigantic. It is huge. And there's no people documenting all of these things going on. They're not documenting all of the cities or towns or villages that are burned or whatever.
Yeah, there's no reason for prosperity.
They don't care.
Like, yeah,
they don't care.
Like, no, they got East Jenkinsville, not West Jenkinsville. Like, oh, okay, my bad. Sorry.
Yeah, these are armies. They're there to get paid to do the job that they're supposed to do. They get to have some spoils of war. They get to shoot their gun off and be aggressive. That's what they're there to do. They're not documenting it. They don't care.
Bro, like I remember watching Lord of War, which is a very poignant movie for me. It's like one of the warlords, like his son drops off Nicolas Cage's character in a hotel. And he leaves two girls in his room, and they're gorgeous. And he's like, oh, the king's sense of humor, two beautiful women in a country, in an area ravaged by HIV/AIDS and not a condom for country, like for miles. And the girls are like, why worry about something that can kill you later when there's so many things that can kill you today? Like, I don't want to die uncomfortable. Like, the fuck? Like, I don't want to get the clap then get shot in the head. That's you don't want a double whammy in those situations. Because it's not like you stub your toe and hit your head. It's like, you get AIDS and get shot in the face. Like, that's what I'm trying to fucking avoid. There's too many whammies. I'll try to avoid the double.
Definitely
the fucking triple.
I don't want STDs in general. That sounds like terrible way to go.
It does. You also don't want the double. Again, STDs, bad. STDs, then shot in the face, horrible. Shot in the face, bad. Shot in the face after figuring out you're pissing fire, horrible. Like, you got to make the best of a bad situation. And getting shot in the face after catching AIDS is not something.
No.
Also, doing cocaine and gunpowder. Bro, y'all bored. That is the shit you try. Like,
that's one of those Nick Cage movies that it shouldn't be good, but it's really good. And I own a lot of Nick Cage movies.
You do. You really do.
I love Nicolas Cage. He is one of the most fun actors because especially when he went broke. Because then he just started doing movies. Oh god, he's been broke. He's been like dirt broke. He bought like a T-Rex skull. And he kept spending all this money he didn't have. And so that's why he's in every movie that exists possible.
That makes sense. Bro, it's different. Also, you're a Coppola. How the fuck do you go broke? You're a Coppola.
Well, there's a... look.
Literally.
Coppola,
like the
Coppola
like
money is still... It's good. But you're talking about like someone that's tens of millions of dollars in debt. Like you, at that point, you're the bank's problem is your debt. Not your problem. So he's fine. But he does like every movie that he can. There's a lot that are real. There's a lot that are good that he did, and then there's a lot that are bad that he did.
There's this one movie, and I think it's on Hulu. I hope it's on Hulu still. But like, there's this disease going around where parents want to kill their children.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And like, so the movie is him trying to kill his kids.
It's him and his wife trying to kill their kids. Yeah.
And then like, his parents show up trying to kill him.
Yeah.
Like, you want to kill your direct descendants, but not like your grandchildren.
I forget what that
movie
is called.
Fucking Nick Cage. Fucking.
Oh yeah, Mom and Dad. That's what it's called.
Yeah,
just Mom and Dad.
Bro, it's just like not desperation, but just like, I don't know what it's like to be so poor and abjectly poor for generations upon generations. That when you get that taste of power, you go butt ass naked wild.
I think not to give them a
villain's backstory to where you can kind of make them sympathize, but like, growing up in, you don't know if you're going to drink clean water this month. And to like, now you have coke and whores money. I can see how that distorts everything. Like, everything is living for the moment. Like, this guy didn't build any infrastructure. This guy didn't do anything for his army to protect his country. Cause he was just like, bro, he was not thinking that. I don't think he ever had the mind to ever think that.
No. And that's why you have the irony of Kabila acting so much like Mobutu. And Mobutu did, like, one of the things I didn't get around to putting in here, because it just wasn't relevant, but it was one of those like weird intrigues. I just couldn't find a place to put it. He had a shitload of kids. And
yeah, that makes
he
sense.
Had kids with, he had it with a bunch of different women, of course. But
that also makes sense.
One woman, he had, I think, two or three kids with her, and then he had two other kids with her sister. And that is a thing to me that I just find insane. Just, I mean, you know, it's not like she had a choice. If she said no, I mean, we know the result. She's in a river.
It's going to happen anyway.
Yeah.
I like you and I want you. You can do this the easy way or the hard way.
Or you can just be floating in the river. You know, one of the three.
Being a booty warrior.
And the thing with Kabila is Kabila proves, and that's why there's a reason I did the Kabila Trump comparison, because it's so, so crazy how accurate it is, even though we don't have nearly as much time with Kabila as we do with Trump.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason I do that comparison is because I think it's important to see that it does not matter if you are born with a wooden spoon, a silver spoon, a golden spoon, a diamond spoon. Leadership is a real quality that exists in some people.
Yeah.
And it's a tangible asset. And Trump and Kabila being so similar in their style, but then seeing how both countries didn't function or did function, Trump, for all of his actions, his decisions, his style, there's still a solid foundation that he cannot crumble on his own. It's not possible. Where with Kabila, there was no solid anything, and because of that, he was able to just do everything wrong possible, and it bites him numerous times, but then it also doesn't. And we'll get into that in the next episode when things get a bit crazy.
Just to talk about it, but just like with Donald Trump, if someone would be like, "Hey, bro, talk to me like that again, I'm gonna fuck you up," and they'd have just said that sternly, he'd have backed off. Because I think he's so afraid of the physical consequences of all that bullshit that he'd be kicking.
Well, and there's
like guys like that are easily to beat. Like, bro, I'm gonna put my foot in your ass. So far, the water from my knee will quench your thirst. Stop some major pain. But, like, you grow up and you see these, like, kind of 80s high school story villains. So it's just, like, and, like, I told my daughter, like, look, if someone's ever, because she's mixed and she's going to a mostly white school, and it's just, like, look, if someone makes you feel bad about yourself and wants to say things mean to you, tell them, hey, can you please stop? You're hurting my feelings. If they continue, say it again. Hey, can you please stop? You're hurting my feelings. If they continue on, hit them with a motherfucking chair. They'll stop. I'm dead fucking serious. Like, I would rather me and my daughter hang out all day because she's suspended for 3 days or a week or whatever, than someone feel that they can because kids like that become Trump, to where no one's afraid of trying their authority, and no one, and everyone's afraid of being disassociated.
Being out of the inner circle, so to speak.
Shouts to AEW. I would rather my child be out of the inner circle for being that big of a rebel, and for letting motherfuckers know I'm willing to take it to a level you aren't, just to prove a fucking point, than to have this asshole permeate through Olin Tangi City schools and then become a non-functioning member of society.
Well, and that's where
a chair to the face will change a lot of people's fucking attitude.
Well, and that's where there's a big divergent from the Kabila Trump thing, because while they're very similar in their styles of how they handle things internally, one thing that Kabila does is he openly does not give any respect and doesn't give a fuck. He's not afraid. He's not afraid to do it to your face. He's also someone who was like a minor warlord for a time.
Yeah. He's so, their life.
Yeah, he's killed people. He himself has murdered people before. So he's not someone who's afraid of face-to-face anything. Whereas a Donald Trump, he's known for not wanting to fire people face-to-face. He's known for doing things and then sulking into the shadows and not being able to be, questioned about his decision-making or anything. But there's where your big switch between those two exists, because Kabila is a very much in-your-face kind of guy, where Trump is not. On a personal level, the bombasticness that they both have in public is very one-to-one. They are both very, and we'll get into this in the final episode of this, they're both very bombastic, very out there, not afraid to call out their perceived enemies. But in private, where Donald Trump is, according to most, if not everyone, does not like confrontation, Kabila thrives on it. He thrives on personal confrontation. That's kind of his thing. Even the whole thing of like, he just put his own people in jail. Why? Because fuck them. He didn't have a reason. He didn't need a reason. He would just do things, and he wouldn't do it from afar. He would make sure that they knew why he did it, and then they would come talk to him after he released them. Like, these are the kind of things that he did.
I guess you gotta give him that.
I'll give him credit for if you're going to be an authoritative dictator, at least he's being it to your face. There's your praise, buddy. That's what you get. I mean, you're dead now, but that's what you get. Spoiler, Kabila's dead. How? We'll find out. Thank you for joining me on part two. We only have one more part before you don't have to learn anything more about this horrifying history that has a great Toto song behind it.
Oh no! Don't, Sean.
I love
Sean,
that.
Don't.
I love that song. Don't worry,
bro. You didn't even have to bring that in.
I didn't have to, but now
that's like me. I'm giving the hat sex with prime Cindy Crawford, like 95. You're like, hey, you know she got herpes, right? Why did you do this? like why did you do this?
It's
like,
you no. And you and the 17 people listening to this are currently telling me to go fuck myself, and that's okay, because you know what you should go listen to? Chaos Therapy. Why don't you give yourself a plug?
Oh,
there, bud,
fucking ass up. Bro, everybody, you know what, there was some, I was trying to record with Mike today, and for some reason the audio would cut out on Anchor, so I need to see what the fuck that's about. But Chaos Therapy is my podcast. It's not as depressing most times.
Sometimes when you have me on, it ventures into that, but hey, you know.
Bro, we get squirrely. But yeah, Chaos Therapy, you can find them everywhere where you listen to podcasts. Again, it's Chaos Therapy, straight out spelling. You all take care of yourselves. Sean, man, love you, brother. This is dope.
I appreciate it. Until next time, when we get to finish out talking about this depressing topic, and then, I don't know, we'll move on to something that hopefully I don't accidentally delete and have to re-record.